Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good evening. This is L.A. Stu. And tonight I'm going to do replay an interview I had last night with John Loftus, who is the author of American Nazi Secret, America's Nazi Secret, I should say, put out by Trinday. And you can go to trinday.com and see his book. It's a fascinating book. And he wrote the Belarus file, or the Belarus secret. It came out back in 1982, I believe, and it was a great bestseller put out by Knopf. And that book was from the Nazis' files from the CIA and the Justice Department, but three quarters of it or more, or half of the information relating to the book was censored by the CIA, so he wasn't able to publish a good part of it. However, what did come out was enough to shock the nation, and he was interviewed by Mike Wallace back then in 60 Minutes, I believe, and that won an Emmy Award for that program. So John has been around quite a while, and he got some interesting things to say. And the book is, fascinating read, you know, for anyone who may have always suspected or have heard about it, you know, that Nazis got into this country. It hasn't really been a big secret. Everybody suspected it. But in this case, John was tracked as a former Justice Department official. He had tracked this case since the 70s, and he broke it wide open. And then, he's just phenomenal what's become of this country and how these people could have gotten away with allowing thousands and thousands of war criminals, people who've done despicable things, to be allowed in this country, and given false birth certificates and forged papers and every other god-awful thing, name changes from murderer to freedom fighter, you know. So it's quite an amazing book, and I hope you'll enjoy it. We'll be on about 8:30. It's half an hour interview, more or less, and so we'll be putting that on in a short while. But I wanted to, I wanted to check out, read a couple new news items possibly, and see what we can come up with. I think you're. I think the from what I've seen recently, and the headlines and other sources about this Obama trip, as it turns out, he's going to a G20 summit and in South Korea, and the reason it's low key is because of the stuff he's trying to do. Cost of the midterms, how politicians spent $4.2 billion on ads, more than any other election in U.S. history. Politicians spent a staggering $4.2 billion on campaign TV ads in the run-up to the last week's midterm elections, it was claimed today. The 1.4 million television spots. 1.4 million television spots were the most of any election in U.S. history, including the 2008 presidential campaign. And some of the cities where candidates have spent the most were in areas most blighted by the nation's economic slump. Yeah, just phenomenal there. One second. Go to the rest of this article. Um, The top of the spending league was Ohio, where Democrats and Republicans battled tight races. Cleveland was first with the state capital, Columbus second, coming in second. Combined politicians and third groups spent $564 million just in Ohio, according to the nonpartisan Campaign Finance Institute. The political spending spree came against a backdrop of state jobless rates of 10%, its highest in 27 years. In Cleveland, one out of every four commercials in the days before the election was paid for by a candidate or a political group, according to the Nielsen company that drew up the list. Fourth in the highest spending ad table was Sacramento in California, where former eBay boss Meg Whitman spent more than $140 million of her own money in her unsuccessful bid to be governor, and wealthy former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina also lost out in the state and the Senate race. The top five was rounded out by Portland, Oregon in third, and Seattle, Washington in fifth place. Springfield in Illinois, Reno, Nevada, and Orlando, and Palm Beach in Florida, all areas badly hit by the recession, round out the top 10 along with Denver and Colorado. The $4.2 billion TV ad total was estimated by research firm Borrell Associates Media Consultants Kantar, put it slightly lower at more than $3 billion. Analysts said prices for television spots doubled and even tripled their usual rates because of the high demand, particularly for coveted 11 p.m. time slots. This is their Christmas day, and someone either buys their toys or they don't, Tony D'Angelo, TV sales director in Columbia, Ohio, told ABC News. Station bosses in Seattle estimated the total revenue for political ads in the city could have run as high as $46 million. That's absolutely amazing. Yeah. Absolutely amazing. So, you wonder how much this presidency cost. It's kind of interesting. You know, $4.2 billion. No, only 300 million citizens. So that's roughly, I don't even know how much. It's $1,000, more than $1,000 per person spent on these political ads. That's in the country. Greenspan admits to rampant fraud and illegal activity in U.S. banking system while on Jekyll Island stage with Bernanke. This is very quick, but it says, Alan Greenspan says the bank's robbed. Let's go to that.
There are two fundamental reforms that we need to get adequate capital and two, to get far higher levels of enforcement of fraud statutes. Existing ones, I'm not even talking about new ones. Things were being done which were certainly illegal and clearly criminal in certain cases, which in fraud, fraud creates very considerable instability in competitive markets. If you cannot trust your counterparties, it won't work. And indeed, we saw that it didn't.
That was Alan Greenspan. Interesting one. Ireland may need an IMF bailout, says New York Times. Say scales of debt is massive. In a front page story on Monday, the New York Times is reporting that Ireland's debt woes have stoked fear that it might even need to follow Greece and request a bailout from the European Union and International Monetary Fund. Such a move could do lasting damage to the Ireland's credit standing, the Times says. In a story entitled Irish Debt Woes Revive Concern About Europe, the newspaper reports that the Irish bond market, already in free fall, plunged further after the government announced massive new spending cuts. Stated that investors took it not as a sign of resolve, but rather of Ireland's desperation and uncertainty about the true extent of its problems. They noted that the yield on Ireland's 10-year bond climbed to 7.6% on Friday, opening a huge gap on the 2.5% interest rate on comparable bonds issued by Germany. The scale of deficits are just as big, said Richard Quinn, professor of international economics at Trinity College in Dublin. The Times notes that Ireland has enough cash on hand to allow it to finance government operations through till June 2011. But the paper says that Ireland may become the poster child for the fact that even drastic measures by European countries will not solve their long-term debt problems. Despite praise for Ireland's austerity program, the Times say Ireland badly underestimated the extent of the debt problem. But as far as the full extent of the banking and real estate bust became evident, it was clear that the government of Prime Minister Cowan, which has been in power since the onset of the crisis more than 2 years ago, had underestimated the cost of fiscal recovery. And the Times notes that the International Monetary Fund argued that the increasing debt ratios among advanced nations need to be addressed. And the paper noted that the leader in such debt is Ireland, whose debt level has almost doubled to nearly 100% of gross national product. Wow. That's not good. That's not good. So they're on their way out the door, too. Hey. Let's see. Here's something interesting. Declassified. Massive Israeli manipulation of U.S. media is exposed. This is going to be interesting. Well, this is by Russian TV. It's about 5 minutes, so let's listen to this.
Now, files declassified in America have revealed covert Republic relations and lobbying activities of Israel in the U.S. The National Archives made the documents public following a Senate investigation. They suggest Israel has been trying to shape media coverage of issues it regards as important. You can download these files from the website of the Institute for Research on Middle Eastern Policy. And we can now cross to Washington and talk to Grant F. Smith, who is the director of this institute. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Smith. I'd like to begin by asking you, what exactly do these files reveal?
These files are from a sealed Senate investigation, which was the result of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the U.S. Department of Justice looking into groups that brought $36 million into the U.S. to plant stories in the U.S. media and promote Israeli foreign policy objectives in the United States. They're extremely relevant because they revealed, for example, a vast effort to divert U.S. attention from the Israeli Dimona nuclear weapons facility by saying it was merely a research center. They carefully tracked how that story was playing in the U.S. media. And they also were using outlets such as The Atlantic magazine, funneling $50,000 into that magazine in a major effort to disrupt a U.S. peace proposal, which would have involved bringing some Palestinian refugees and allowing them to return to their homes and properties in Israel. The interesting thing about these... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, what about the media, their side? How susceptible are they to Israeli lobbying?
Well, this reveals essentially that major U.S. publications that were on the receiving end of the $36 million really fell into line for a whole host of initiatives. Now, the Senate investigation was a failure, and they essentially heavily censored the Senate transcript and then put all of these extremely damning files into sealed records for years and years so that nobody could really see what was going on. And unfortunately, the groups that were involved in this, they were ultimately forced to register as foreign agents and disclose their activities. They simply transferred all of these activities into a group called the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. So it's extremely enlightening for Americans to see how media influence functions by looking at internal documents from this investigation.
Well, it also makes you ask, how much will Americans really see if the U.S. media is so affected by these lobbyists, no?
Well, yeah, that's exactly the case, because once again, you know, we're replaying history. Now, instead of trying to divert attention away from nuclear weapons in the Middle East, a magazine, again, The Atlantic, is on the forefront of an AIPAC drive to get the United States to attack Iran's nuclear facilities, again, now under the pretext that they're nuclear weapons sites. So for the United States, it's extremely important for people to see this media influence and the mechanics of it, because over the passage of time, this has only gotten worse.
What does it suggest about U.S. policy in the Middle East? Is it being shaped around the interest of Israel as you see it?
Well, we've done a lot of work over the years obtaining documents about Israeli policy initiatives in the United States. And the documentary record suggests a heavy influence on the part of Israeli politicians and various parastatal groups that work tightly with Israel without disclosing those relationships. They have successfully built a campaign financing system in the United States that's extremely effective at pushing Israeli objectives by withholding or dispersing campaign funding to U.S. politicians. So there is a high degree of control that's in place, but for your average American, it's almost completely hidden.
Interesting stuff. Grant F. Smith, Director of the Institute for Research on Middle Eastern Policy, thank you very much for your time.
And hope you enjoyed that. That was enlightening, too, I thought. But here, this kind of leads into our interview tonight with John Loftus, and what happens so often with CIA whitewashing. The Presidential Commission whitewashes the BP disaster as well. It's really quite amazing, you know. So let me see if we can get to this one. This article was written for the Global Research .ca by Jason Leopold. As special prosecutor declines to file a criminal charge over destruction of CIA torture tape. Nearly 3 years after he was appointed to investigate the destruction of at least 92 interrogation videotapes, a dozen of which showed two high-value detainees being subjected to waterboarding and various other torture techniques by CIA interrogators, Special Prosecutor John Durham has determined that he does not have enough evidence to secure an indictment against anyone responsible for the purge. Department of Justice spokesman Matthew Miller said in a statement Tuesday that Durham, a USA attorney from Connecticut, has concluded that he will not pursue criminal charges for the destruction of interrogation tapes. And the statute of limitations for bringing criminal charges related to the destruction of tapes ran out Tuesday. Okay, Truthout contacted Durham spokesman Tom Carson late Monday evening, raising questions about whether Durham's investigation was ongoing in the light of the statute of limitation expiring, or whether he had been concluded his probe. And Carson, in a mail sent to Truthout hours before Miller issued a statement, said Durham's investigation is still an open matter. In response to additional inquiries requesting clarification of the statement, Carson said the investigation is still an open matter, but DOJ will not pursue criminal charges for the destruction of the tapes. And two people close to the probe told Truthout that they were told that means were in a were means told that means there is a possibility Durham could pursue other charges such as false statements. The target of the probe made during the course of the investigation, but they doubt Durham would do that. And the article goes on. I suggest you might be, if you're interested, to go to globalresearch.ca and check that out. Okay. Let me go back here and hit this one more. Presidential Commission whitewashes BP disaster. On Monday, the chief counsel of President Obama's commission on the BP oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico claimed his investigation found no evidence the oil giant sacrificed safety to save money before the April 20th explosion in Deepwater Horizon. The blowout killed 11 workers and led to the worst environmental catastrophe in U.S. history. To date, we have not seen a single instance where a human being made a conscious decision to favor dollars over safety. Fred Bartlett, general counsel for the National Commission on BP Deepwater Horizon Oil Spill and Offshore Drilling, asserted on November 8th, Monday, that was the first day of a hearing in Washington to present the commission's preliminary findings. And Bartlett's statements underscore the fact that the commission's inquiry is a whitewash aimed at its protecting the assets of BP and covering up for the Obama administration's own complicity in the disaster. Should the company be found criminally negligent, it could face fines of $4,300 for every barrel of oil spilled into the Gulf. If the disaster is determined to be the result of an accident, the fine is three times less. The difference amounts to billions of dollars of savings for BP. They're going to let these bastards off the hook, you know. It's really quite frightening. Hold on a second. I get the rest of the article here, but... This article is very long. I think we're going to go from that. I just got one more here to see if I can. This is an interesting one. A young Jewish proud Netanyahu's speech disrupted. The videotape above is a number of young people working with Jewish Voice for Peace disrupting Netanyahu's speech at Florida. They have started a campaign called Young Jewish and Proud as part of this initiative. I was proud to see my friends Matan Cohen and Emily Rather and Ray Abli among those who stood up to scream at Netanyahu. I was scared to see the audience reaction. The boos, the cheering, the ripping apart of the posters. They made it very clear that what was going on there, it was a hate rally. Okay. So let's go to that one and see what comes up here. On November 8th, young Jews challenged leadership at Traditional Jewish Federation. Let me just go back here a second. Reading this here before the stuff. November 8th, 2010. Young Jews challenged leadership at the Jewish Federation General Assembly in New Orleans. They disrupted Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech to say, Israel's action delegitimize it. Not who's working to put an end to it. Violations of international law.
on Israel's legitimacy is another game. We know from our history that attacks on the Jews were often preceded by attempts to delegitimize the Jewish people, to paint them as vile criminals, as the scourge of humanity. And this is why the attempts by our enemies and their misguided fellow travelers to delegitimize the Jewish state must be countered.
Silencing dissidents is defiling Israel. I stand up with these people. I appreciate what they're doing, trying to bring some integrity to the process. So anyway, okay. I think we're gonna it's 8:30. I want to get to that to our interview now. Our interview is with John Loftus, who getting there, folks. Hang on a second. I kind of misplaced it. I had it up there today. I was just trying to find it. My God. My desktop is so loaded. Okay, bear with me, folks. Oh, sorry, folks. I should have had this better prepared. I know it's here somewhere. I know it's right on here. I just set it up earlier. Be extremely stubborn about it, I guess. Okay, just give me another second here. I'm sorry to hold you up on this. It's really annoying. Seriously, must just don't understand why I can't find it for some reason. It's just not. Not having any luck here. I apologize. Cannot definitely figure out where I put this this file. Anyway, let's see if one last shot here. I wish I could talk and do this at the same time, but I cannot, and I apologize.
Creditors in Commerce class.
Okay. Let me, while I have it here, might as well play you this thing. This is, I really am sorry. Let's see if I can find this back again. I'm going to go back to playing Dixie here, I guess. And I again, I apologize for some reason I cannot find that my interview, and I apologize for that. But let's see if I can find another some more information for you. Interesting. I have to wait for this site to come back up. I'm at a point where I need to. I wanted to. I was hoping that we might. You might hear this tonight. U.S. debt, or rather, U.S. black debt hole. We want you all bankrupt. I thought this was extremely frightening when I heard it, but it was it's where Obama is, and it's by an economist who is stating that the U.S. wants China to pay for hostile American foreign policy. And they are also at a G.S. summit in South Korea. I don't know if I don't think I played this. In fact, I know I didn't. But I want you to, I'd like you to listen to this tonight. I think it'll be quite an eye-opener. And it's by Russian TV.
Dr. Michael Hudson is a renowned economist. He's a Wall Street analyst. He's a professor, and he's an economic advisor to countries. He's also the author of Super Imperialism, The Economic Strategy of the American Empire. Recently, he's been outspoken on the global currency tensions, what some are calling a currency war. And this will be a key issue for world leaders at the G20 summit, which is coming up in South Korea. So we wanted to get his input. I want to thank you for joining us, Dr. Hudson. Now, we recently saw last month G20 leaders come to some kind of an agreement on not competitively devaluing their currencies, with details to come later at this G20 summit. But with no details and with no real way to enforce this, do you think it will be possible for them to reach a deal, and would it even matter?
There's no possibility of any agreement when the United States is declaring financial war on other countries. The United States is going to China and saying, we want you to commit economic suicide just like Japan did. We want you to follow the same thing. We want you to revalue your currency. We want you to squeeze your companies. We want you to go bankrupt so we can make a profit at your expense. We want you, the Chinese, to allow our banks to gamble on your currency and make a huge gain on foreign exchange speculation so that our banks can get out of the problem that we've got them into. Will you please help us by going bankrupt for our benefit? Well, you can imagine what the Chinese are saying. They're laughing. They're thinking, you know, are you guys joking? Countries don't work like that. So the American policy is not only to devalue the dollar, but to flood the global economy with money. And this means that other economies are facing an onslaught of American money coming in to buy their land, their buildings, their real estate, their companies, their currency, and essentially you have America's financial system and the banks acting as an army to raid foreign currencies. You don't have a deal unless you have penalties for breaking an agreement. If you don't have a penalty for breaking an agreement, there is no agreement. All there is yet another broken promise. That's unfortunately how the United States has been conducting diplomacy for the last 50 years. Deals are for other people to follow the United States. It puts itself over and above the agreements.
Okay. The G20 reached this deal, though, by giving more voting power to emerging nations. Clearly there's been a shift in the balance of power in the world that is starting to be reflected in global governing bodies.
Giving a country a voice in the IMF is like telling an ambassador, you can go to Times Square and you can get a microphone and you can yell to Times Square. It doesn't make any difference at all. The IMF philosophy is a very pro-U.S. philosophy. Only the United States has veto power within the IMF. The philosophy of the IMF is that in order to increase the economic surplus, you have to reduce living standards and you have to essentially impose austerity.
What about the G20 then? Where does that fit in?
It doesn't have a body of theory that is based on economic austerity for the rest of the world and a free lunch for the United States.
U.S. President Barack Obama will meet with Chinese leader Hu Jintao on the sideline of the summit, and one of the main issues the U.S. has been pressing for is for China to revalue its currency, saying that it's been undervaluing its currency to boost exports. Can the U.S. even make this argument?
The big fiction is that the United States' balance of payments is caused by trade. The deficit is caused by a capital outflow of money managers here putting their money abroad in the military deficit. China says, look, we've been financing your budget deficit with our $2.5 trillion of foreign exchange. You're spending your budget deficit on military bases to ring us around, to take aggressive action against us, to put your spy planes where they bump into our spy planes, to interfere in our waters. You want us to pay for your military budget, to threaten us, to make us do what you want us to do? You must be crazy.
What leverage does the U.S. even have? It's the largest debtor nation in the world. China is the largest creditor nation in the world. The U.S. relies on China to finance its $14 trillion debt. How does President Obama have any leverage?
Well, that's the problem. Obama doesn't really have any leverage at all because he needs the favor from China and from other countries, from Brazil, from Russia, from India, of saying, please accept our IOUs, our paper dollars, even though we have no way of paying for it, and even though we can never pay off these debts, please accept them and let us buy out your real estate and your companies with dollars that we'll never repay. That's what he's asking for. There's not very much leverage in that position. And when you, the question is how you can wrap it in a nice way, and America can talk, let's about, talk about how we can have equilibrium, and other countries can say, but you're not in equilibrium yourself. You, America, are the cause of our disequilibrium. Why don't you do what you've told us to do? The IMF tells other countries, raise your interest rates if you have a deficit. Sell off your industry. Privatize it if you have a deficit. China is treating the U.S. dollar reserves it has like a hot potato. How do they get rid of them? They've wanted to do two things. First of all, they wanted to reciprocate and buy U.S. companies, just as the U.S. wanted to buy China. The U.S. says, we will not let you buy filling stations here or refineries. You can't buy in America. We can buy in you. You can't buy in America. You have foreign takeovers all the time of U.S. companies, but they're European takeovers or they're takeovers by friendlies. So obviously, America views China as a potential enemy, which is what it is on the Pentagon's list of strategic enemies. So why should China finance America's military spending around it? That's what the dollars are worth, are being thrown off. America's throwing off these dollars in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Japan, in its bases around the world. That's what the deficit is, and that's what the U.S. isn't talking about. That's what they're talking about in China, because when I go to China and talk to the officials, that's what we talk about.
Is the U.S. hypocritical in its dealings with China when it doesn't even talk about quantitative easing while it's printing trillions of dollars?
The U.S. has benefited from what is in effect a double standard because of the dollar standard. The U.S. debt is other people's asset. When you pump, when you spend more than you get, then other countries end up with the dollars. The United States is the only country which has run a balance of payments deficit and has not raised its interest rate and has not raised its taxes.
Now, this is something that you also dealt with in your book, Super Imperialism, that the U.S. has been able to get other countries to finance its debt, to essentially finance its wars, the 50% of its discretionary budget that is devoted to defense. How has the U.S. maintained this?
It happened largely by inertia. After World War II, the United States had most of the world's gold. And by 1950, the United States had 80% of the world's gold stock. So the dollar was as good as gold. Other countries began to accumulate dollars because until 1971, they could exchange them for gold. Once the United States stopped converting the dollars into gold, people really didn't have enough of a foreign currency to hold in their foreign reserve. There's no way in the world that America can ever pay the foreign government debt that it owes, because it's running a military deficit, a capital account deficit, and a trade deficit. So what is the point of any country holding more dollars in the central bank if it can never get paid? And there's a basic mathematical principle. A debt that can't be paid won't be. So other countries are trying to prevent getting more dollars, and they're trying to circumvent the dollar. That's why in the last month, China has negotiated currency swaps with Turkey, India, Brazil, Malaysia, Russia. That's what the meetings in Yekaterinburg were last year in Russia, to make the BRIC countries with their associated countries such as Iran and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization operate without using the dollar. So the effect of quantitative easing by the Fed is to turn the dollar into a pariah currency that everybody's trying to avoid because nobody wants them. You can't use them to invest in the United States because of the nationalism here. Other countries don't want dollars. What is the point of accepting more dollars?
So then what is the future of the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency?
It means that it's finished. Other countries, and basically all the countries at the G20 meeting that are coming up in Korea, realize that the dollar's era is over. The question is, how do you bury it in a way that is polite? You want to do it slowly. You don't want to do it suddenly. But very politely, they'll tell the U.S., your time is over.
And what does this mean for the future of the U.S. as a global power?
It will slowly shrink because how can it support its military bases abroad if nobody will accept its dollars? How can it import from other countries if people won't accept dollars in excess of what the United States earns? The United States won't be able to buy other bonds or invest in other countries abroad because the countries will not let other Americans or other investors using dollars buy their domestic currency to pay for exports or to pay sellers of these companies. So essentially the dollar will be a paper currency that can't be used. So the irony of this is that the Federal Reserve, in order to save banks that got into trouble by running crooked, dishonest operations, to save these banks, they're sacrificing America's position in the world.
And when does this all come to a head?
In Korea, at G20 meetings.
I want to thank you so much for talking to us about this.
Well, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
So that was U.S. Black Debt Hole, the great, very, very good piece. Really enjoyed it. And let's see. This is another one I wanted to play to you today. Alan Greenstrand's The Banks Robbed.
There are two fundamental reforms that we need to get adequate capital and two, to get far higher levels of enforcement of fraud statutes. Existing ones, I'm not even talking about new ones. Things were being done which were certainly illegal and clearly criminal in certain cases, which, I mean, fraud is a fact. Fraud creates very considerable instability in competitive markets. If you cannot trust your counterparties, it won't work. And indeed, we saw that it didn't.
Alan Greenspan saying that what happened is criminal. Let's see. Let's go on to, I think it's a few minutes I have left. I think what I'd like to do is, I put up on my, unfortunately I don't have the programming set up for my website, but to post these Facebook apps and stuff on there, but I should have shortly, but I'm annoying, that I like to do is I would like to finish off tonight's tonight's show with a quick segment of George W. Bush's
you'll be...
Let me...
There would have been a deficit, but there wouldn't have been the commensurate kick to our economy.
Are you having burritos for lunch?
That there be a stable Iran. Iran that is capable of rejecting Iranian influence. I mean, Iraq.
The best way to defeat this enemy in the long run is to deny them the recruiting tools that are, and recruitment made possible by resentment.
8 years later.
It just seems like I was here yesterday. I was.
I'd like to stay here all day, but I gotta go to Vegas. Something about what goes on there, stays there, or something like that, you know. Coming. Welcome to the White House. Thanks for coming.
If you don't stand for anything, you don't stand for anything. If you don't stand for something, you don't stand for anything.
Fool me once. Shame on you. Fool me, can't get fooled again. My speech to the nation, whatever you want to call it. I know the human being and fish can coexist peacefully. The left hand now knows what the right hand is doing.
Yourself, you redneck. All right, and that was really good. I hope you enjoyed the show tonight.
had a great time. We went a little bit over, but it's been a lot of fun. I wanted to refer you back to my website, our Facebook right now, on Leo Steele. Okay, I invite all of you to be my friends who are listening, and those of you who are my friends listening, I appreciate your support. But I'll keep you listening. As far as the you can check out Facebook. I have a ton of these things on Facebook right now, I think you're going to enjoy them. Plus, I hope you look at you go in and look at everything that I've done there. Kind of orchestrated it, a different profile page and wall, so that there's a whole lot of links and articles that I've written and so on. So I just hope that you might be able to check that out. I think it'll be of interest to you. That's under Leo Steele. So thank you, and